Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, May 6th. We continue to have conversations around the Jones Act. The president suspended the maritime shipping law for another 90 days as the war in Iran stretches on. We hear from a Hawaii Harbors group about its take on what this means. We also learn about research that could help officials when it comes to weather patterns and storms like Kona Lows or super typhoons. We hear about the creation of a new state office of cemeteries, how drones are taking to the skies to help us better manage the graveyards. On the Manu Minute, we expand our understanding of the stories of our native birds through chants, olelo and mo'olelo. Plus, we learn about the state bird and its ties to our native plants. We reintroduce you to the rarest goose in the world. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The decision to extend the waiver for a controversial maritime law called the Jones Act certainly raised more than a few eyebrows. President Donald Trump issued the waiver shortly after ordering the attack on Iran. And now as the war stretches past 60 days, the president extended the waiver for another 90 days. Earlier on the show, we heard from the Hawaii Shippers Council, which pointed out while members in the maritime industry initially protested the waiver, no one has filed a legal challenge over it. As of late April, some 40 vessels have taken advantage of the waiver. None have come to Hawaii. And today we hear from the Hawaii Harbor Users Group, which represents the major shipping carriers, Matson, Pesha, and Young Brothers, as well as other union groups which work our harbors. Melissa Pavasek is the executive director of the Users Group. We talked to her earlier this morning.
You know, the Hawaii Harbors Users Group is composed of container shipping, cruise lines, and many other companies, including a Hawaii-based energy company. And we have not opposed the waiver. Our understanding of the Jones Act waiver is that it's pertinent to military needs and that it doesn't apply to regular commercial shipping. But the bottom line is we continue to believe and support the Jones Act because it's a time-proven system for ensuring reliable shipping to Hawaii.
And, you know, we have heard critics of the Jones Act say that it just adds to our shipping costs.
You know, the Jones Act, its primary purpose or its most pertinent use for Hawaii is the assurance that we'll have a stable, reliable domestic system. So it does not prevent foreign ships from coming to Hawaii. In fact, foreign vessels regularly call on Hawaii ports going through Honolulu Harbor. The cost, we've seen economists estimate something like 1 to 5% of Hawaii cost of goods relates to the Jones Act. But overall, if we did not have the Jones Act, we would be risking having that consistent, reliable source of goods. I'm a former Aloha Airlines employee myself, and I know that there's this myth that if we just focus on lower prices or increased competition, all will be well. But when Mesa Airlines came to Hawaii and dropped the price of, you know, inter-island travel to $20, it put Aloha out of business and 3,000 employees, including myself, lost their jobs. So we definitely are cognizant of the importance of pricing for our economy, but we really need to ensure that Hawaii gets reliable shipping.
You know, and we've heard that our shipping lines are our lifelines, you know, that we only have, what is it, a week of stuff that's warehoused, you know, and we just can't afford to have anything happen to our harbors. And I think, you know, with the users, I mean, everybody is cognizant of, you know, just the times that we're living in now where, you know, because of that, the Iran war, you know, we're seeing fuel costs go up and transportation and travel costs are starting to kick in now as this war stretches into its second month. But yeah, how are you looking at that?
You know, we just, the Hawaii Harbors Users Group just received an energy briefing from one of our members, and we're not currently seeing any impacts in Hawaii from the shipping issues concerning energy supply to Hawaii, but I know that is something that we're monitoring closely. We recently received a briefing from the State Department of Transportation, and our harbors deputy informed us that they've been very successful in getting over $100 million of federal funds for Hawaii for harbors infrastructure, and that seems really important to lowering costs overall in Hawaii.
Yes, I know we're all anxiously waiting the opening of the Kapalama Terminal, just, you know, looking at ways to make the harbors more efficient. But, you know, certainly the whole idea of we are vulnerable out here in the Pacific, and whether it's, you know, our making sure that we've got enough energy reserves to do what we need to do to make our economy spin, right? Those are just all really important components of a healthy economy.
Absolutely. And I think aside from this myth that we should only be concerned with the price, whereas reliability is so important, I think there is also a misperception that Hawaii is somehow just on the way between Asia and the West Coast, when in reality, shipping paths and routes generally would bypass Hawaii, and we're so small and our shipping infrastructure is so constrained here that larger ships or the largest ships can't necessarily provide us goods here. So there's some logistics issues that pertain to all of this. And as I said, we get some foreign vessels calling on Hawaii ports all the time anyway. So we really believe that this waiver hasn't had any impact yet, and that there is an important role for the Jones Act for maintaining Hawaii's reliable shipping.
Yeah, and you know, the question is, how long is this war going to last, right? No one wants a protracted conflict. You know, like I said, we have limited supplies in reserve, and so we are vulnerable to disruptions. But, you know, I know in checking with PAR and Island Energy, you know, they have no plans to bring in any shipments. But, you know, Hawaiian Electric has said they're going to have to raise their rates just because of the energy situation. You know, it's like I said, we're all hoping that this conflict gets resolved soon, and so there won't be any deep lasting impact.
Well, you know, when we're talking about the price of energy, the price of toilet paper, toothpaste, or anything that we have to ship here, the shipping portion is just one of many factors. So the entire supply chain can get disrupted when there are conflicts out there. I can't really speak to how long that might last, but definitely want to assure that we have consistent, reliable service, especially being so geographically isolated. The fact is that over 80% of all our goods in Hawaii are shipped here, and up to 90%+ are through the supply chain, either through shipping or air transport. So there's just no avoiding the fact that we need to have things shipped in. And this Jones Act, as well as our hub and spokes system, where everything comes through Honolulu Harbor, you know, this is really the time-proven strategies that we need to keep our economy flowing.
Well, you know, when you say that the Jones Act waiver that was meant to strengthen the military's
options,
yeah. I mean, so would you hear that directly from the administration?
You know, my understanding from our Hawaii Harbors users is there are sections of the U.S. law, and the one that this current waiver is pertains specifically to military. There could be or might, you know, at some point be the section that pertains to commercial shipping. But I guess in any case, the real thing that I wanted to mention today and to share with you is to assure, you know, the community that we already have access to foreign vessels. And so this idea that we need a waiver in order to be served directly from other countries is not the case. I know you mentioned that there had been some anecdotal comments that we were receiving, or there were a couple ships destined for Hawaii under this waiver. And I think it's now become clear that we haven't received any additional ships, at least not as of yet, under the waiver. And I just wanted to clarify that the Hawaii Harbors Users Group and our members haven't been opposing this waiver. You know, supporting whatever flexibility is needed is something that is consistent with our mission.
Yes, and I did reach out to Hawaiian Cement, and It's saying that, you know, it has no plans to bring in any shipments under the waiver as well, that they have no need to. So, yeah, it's just a more of a wait and see. And again, hoping that this conflict ends quickly.
Well, it's an opportunity to talk about the supply chain. And I know people don't often think about how did their toilet paper get on that shelf at Long's Drug or wherever they purchased it from. But we, Hawaii Harbor's user group, has launched an initiative called Supply Chain Hawaii, and we have a website with some information about where our goods and products come from and how they get here, and whether it's working with students or people entering the maritime workforce or policy leaders or just community members, that's a good place to find information about the supply chain. Okay. We're really excited about promoting maritime careers. And that also relates to the Jones Act because it supports good paying jobs, not just in Hawaii, but across the country. And we recently went to a Hawaii job fair for high school students. And it's just really exciting to see them. We have a close partnership with the Hawaii Pilots Association, as well as the DOT and the Coast Guard. And they're all very interested in recruiting for future Coast Guard members, pilots, and other workers in the maritime industry.
We've been hearing from Melissa Pavlicek, Executive Director of the Hawaii Harbors Users Group, talking to us this morning about the extension of the waiver of the maritime law, the Jones Act, which is due to the prolonged war with Iran, which is now moving into its third month. To find out more about the supply chain campaign, check out our website for links later today.
Support for HPR comes from Small Business Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, partnering with HMAA to provide health insurance for businesses across multiple industries. Learn more at smallbizhawaii.com.
Officials are warning that we could be in for more intense storms this hurricane season as we move into what's called El Nino season with warmer ocean temperatures. A new study released by the University of Hawaii can predict climate patterns and the likelihood of storms, including super typhoons, up to 15 months in advance. It combines two simple data sets, ocean surface temperature and height, to accurately forecast without the need of complex models or artificial intelligence. UH researcher Yuxing Wong spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about how this new model can help provide early warning to communities and governments in order to potentially reduce impacts like flooding or wildfires from related weather patterns. Wong starts off by defining what El Nino and La Nina events are.
It's just a natural weather or climate phenomena. It can shift from La Nina, which is what typically call it a cold phase, and neutral phase, which is normal condition, and El Nino, which is a warmer condition. So it's actually a quite coupled processes between the ocean, the cloud, and the wind. But when we measure how strong an El Nino or La Nina is, we typically use an index called Nino 3.4, which is basically an area over the central and eastern equatorial Pacific, and you just collect that temperature over that area. We call it ENSO region, and then you do an area average. If it's warmer than normal, then it tend to be an El Nino. If it's colder than normal, then it tend to be a La Nina.
And you guys have come up with a new model, is it, to predict that?
Yes, exactly. So firstly, I would like to explain why we're trying to predict that. El Nino or La Nina, I think I would call it the most powerful climate pattern that influenced the global weather and climate. And if we can predict it, say, a year ahead, and if we can do it as accurate as possible, then we can probably provide some early warnings and let the governments take adaptations in advance to reduce like the impacts caused by ENSO as much as possible. the model that you mentioned, yes, we are trying to predict the El Nino and La Nina as well. And that is a really simple and statistical model. So you probably heard a lot of models nowadays, like using AI and use a lot of data to train a model, but we are trying to bring it back and keep it simple. So we're trying to dig into the key physics mechanism of ENSO, like thinking about what drives ENSO, what can be the key mechanism and provide the key predictability. When I say predictability, it means where you can potentially get the prediction more accurate. So we combined, we call it two climate memories. One is called Hasselman memory. One is called the working memory. So for the Hasselman memory, he is a Nobel Prize winner, and he found that the ocean itself has memory. Say you got a warm water here, and it won't cool down immediately. It will cool down like gradually. So the warm, we call it ocean heat content over the equatorial Pacific, it can potentially cause the El Nino, because you can imagine that a lot of heat is stored in the subsurface of the ocean, and it's easily to, you know, transfer the heat to the surface. And so if you can measure the subsurface ocean heat content accurately, then you can probably predict the El Nino correct. And Klaus Wörke, which was called working memory, is a person who firstly found that, like, you can use in the sea level changes as one of the proxies to represent the subsurface ocean heat content because of the thermal expansion theory. And yeah, we just combine these two memories, like two core memories that can explain ENSO's mechanism and keep everything simple, like the Occam razor theory, if you like. Like, if there's no need, you should just keep things simple, and it's the best way to explain it.
Yeah, and I really do enjoy that that idea of just having these two simple tools and putting them together. And, you know, I think a lot of people see El Nino and they see La Nina, and they know that it means that the ocean is hotter, but I don't think they fully understand maybe all of the consequences or outcomes that can come from that higher ocean temperature. Could you maybe just lay out what they can kind of expect, I guess, if it's being called an El Nino summer versus a La Nina?
Okay, so the impact of El Nino and La Nina are different regionally. Let's say if you're in Hawaii, then I want to claim that the El Nino tend to peak in the Christmas, so it will be the winter of Hawaii, but it will gradually develop from probably boreal spring and boreal summer. So if it's summer in Hawaii, you'll probably get weaker trade winds, you'll probably get wetter air. And if it, during the winter, is the it could be tend to be drier, and then you'll be higher risk for the wildfire or the droughts. If it's La Nina, then it will tend to be wetter, so it'll be probably more flooding risk.
You had kind of touched on it, saying that a lot of you can let the local governments know that, you know, there's a La Nina or an El Nino, and we need to prepare for that. Could you just expand on that point a little bit of like what that preparation can mean?
That's a great question. And I think it's a tough task, actually, because it's related to, you know, the communications between scientists and the government and the related community. Like, whether your prediction is trustworthy, how should I believe that? If it's like wrong prediction, then I take actions in advance, I'd say, because I was living in Tasmania, Australia during my PhD. And so during El Nino, sometimes it get or La Nina, sometimes you get marine heat waves, and it can influence the fishery there. There's a lot of lobsters or abalone, things like that. And some of the fishery industry might take some predictions and they do some actions in advance, like take their lobsters or abalone like to like deeper in the water so it can get colder during the El Nino, something like that. But it can take efforts and take money as well. But sometimes if your prediction is wrong, they'll get frustrated and say, hey, I take these actions, but it doesn't really come here. So I think it's a tough task, like how to communicate between the scientist prediction tool and the related community. Mm-hmm. Although the predictions say, hey, there is a high risk that it will be a strong El Nino this year, but the prediction can be wrong. It happens actually before in 2014, like almost every single computer models, they predict it will be an El Nino year by the end of 2014, but it actually doesn't. It's a neutral ENSO year, just because during the boreal summer, there is a we call it easterly wind burst. So it stops the development of El Nino in the summer, and it eventually end up with a very neutral condition. So yeah, even the El Nino prediction, it can have a huge uncertainty. And for the local processes, it will be a higher uncertainty, although it tends to be influenced by El Nino, La Nina, but it's not 100% story.
That's so interesting that like all these computers and all these models can say it's going to be an El Nino, and then a gust of probably a pretty big gust of wind can just stop that from happening.
Yeah, definitely. It happens. And I really like a quote from Klaus Wörke, which is the person who generated the Wörke memory. He said, "I'm glad if the prediction failed. That means the mother nature knows more than us." Yeah, I really like that one. So it is totally acceptable. We always have disclaimers for our prediction, like this could be wrong, models could be wrong, models could make mistakes. So it does a pretty well, great job, but we cannot guarantee that it is totally correct.
And I think in your role, it seems like there's a lot of power at play. You're predicting something that is so powerful and can, you know, really influence a lot. I guess, why do you do it? Why do you think it's so important that we have this research and we have these models here in place?
That's actually a great, and I feel like it's a philosophy question. Like, why did you do that? This could mean a lot because my family, even they are very interested in ENSO. They all know El Nino and La Nina, because I feel like when I talk about marine heat waves, sometimes they feel confused, but they basically all know El Nino and La Nina. They always ask me, like, will there be an El Nino or La Nina? Will we got a hotter summer in China? So, yeah, I think I probably just want to, you know, motivate from some really great work previously and trying to answer my family's questions. And if I can answer their questions to some extent, I will be happy. But definitely, people will feel benefit from all kinds of different El Nino prediction. It can probably give you full story and with uncertainty as well, to give you a picture of what will probably be happening this year.
That was University of Hawaii postdoctoral researcher Yuxing Wang. She spoke with Kevin Allen about predicting the future of El Nino Southern Oscillation, or ENSO. We'll have a link to the research on our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin June 1st, OLLIUHM.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the new tech right and its alliance with the Trump administration. We talk with George Packer about his Atlantic article focusing on how tech venture capitalists who are heavily invested in AI and cryptocurrency are influencing Trump's policies related to their own investments. Trump has made billions on crypto. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Electric, helping residents and businesses be prepared and informed in emergency situations with the Emergency Preparedness Handbook. Download at hawaiianelectric.com/prepare.
You know, on our show yesterday, we heard from Acting Lieutenant Governor Keith Regan about balancing his new role with his existing position as the state comptroller at the Department of Accounting and General Services. Regan just set up a new cemetery office, which has begun using drones to survey all 8 of the state cemeteries. HPR's Maddie Bender spoke with Regan and James Carota of DAGS. Our cemeteries have fallen into disrepair, and this work is a long time coming. Regan starts us off.
We recognized when I came on board as comptroller that this responsibility by statute was with our department. And so for the last 2.5, 3 years, we've been working towards formalizing our responsibilities related to the statute and seeking funding, as well as other resources such as manpower to be able to properly staff up the office to make sure that we're taking care of our duties and responsibilities related to these final resting places where many of our loved ones and family members are currently interred. So it's a very important process for us. It's taken us a while, but DAGS has had this responsibility for probably a few decades, I would think, at this point. And it's just a fascinating responsibility that is with our department, even though we don't typically deal with land-related issues. We do deal with facility and maintenance issues. And I guess that's why they decided that DAGS was the right department to place this responsibility in. General Services, which is sort of the GS in our DAGS name, seems to attract a lot of interesting things, and this is one of those aspects.
Kind of the overflow projects or the island of misfit toys.
But, that's a great way to put it.
James, chime in here, because we don't think about our cemeteries that often or the state of them, but what are just, I mean, some of those top level facts that listeners should know about the state of our cemeteries currently?
So current state, it hasn't been maintained like a very active cemetery. So headstones have become undulated. The terrain is sunken. We're trying to keep it as presentable as possible, keep the grass down, be sure there's water, because we have indications that there are visitors coming and leaving flowers. We see that evidence. So we're trying to make it safe for the visitors, keep it accessible. It attracts vagrancy. We're showing our presence there now. We're doing surveys and things to figure out what is our best next move once we have all this information about the contours of it. And it shows us exactly how much it takes to do something with it. And we're looking to present options to the comptroller and then circulate that to for public input.
We'll talk about overall the state of our cemeteries. I'm sure among the 8, it varies, but there are certainly state cemeteries that are not in very good shape right now.
Correct. I guess the most visited is and most famous is the Makiki Cemetery. It has the most active visitors coming and going. It's rather well maintained because it's adjacent to other cemeteries. On the other extreme, you have something like the Waianae Japanese Cemetery in Waianae Valley. There are visitors because now that we have a cemetery office, we're getting more calls in, and visitors are expressing both their, their pleasure that we're now putting attention on it. And they relate their stories of how they've been taking care of graves for generations. Now these opportunities come to us and an honor to us to listen to these stories and decide how to best manage that type of visitor. And yet there's a large number of graves there that are either unmarked or stones have been vandalized and destroyed that we're trying to figure out who is there. That's the two extremes of it.
Exactly. It's a question about dignity, right,
Keith? It is. It absolutely is. And that's what I think has really motivated us to seek funding and support from the legislature, to seek the positions to be able to maintain and manage these responsibilities. And this is not something that is going to be done tomorrow. This is something that we need to make a long-term investment. And we've been very fortunate that the governor, Governor Green, understood what we were trying to accomplish through this process, allowed us to put it into our budget request, and that the legislature embraced it and understood how important this was, not just to the department, but to our citizens who have loved ones that are in these final resting places throughout our state. And so I think a lot of legislators over the years have been getting calls from constituents asking about the state of repair of these particular cemeteries and what is the state doing. And I'm sure there's been some frustration. However, when we approach them about this concept to be able to fund the work that needs to be done to maintain the cemeteries and those positions, they quickly embraced it and helped to support it get through. And now we've got the permanent funding to be able to move forward, which is really exciting for me because now we can do things like fix the fences and maintain the grounds better. And as Jimmy was kind of talking about, some of the headstones being overturned or having degraded over time, perhaps even repairing some of those so that we can show the kind of respect that is due to these individuals that are in our cemeteries that we're responsible for.
And one of the projects that funding is going toward now is this drone survey of the cemeteries to really just get a lay of the land. But Jimmy, talk more about why that's important and what's that going to show you?
So the survey has two aspects to it. One is a traditional property line survey. We want to understand any type of encroachments that both our property is doing on neighboring private property and vice versa. If there's been encroachment, we have to address those. So that's one part of the survey. The other is to use drones to do basically LIDAR for vegetation and contour surveying to understand the current condition. And it, in the engineering terms, it gives us a way of estimating the type of financial effort it takes to restore it back to, say, a level grade and repair headstones. We're trying to use all technologies to get this as rapidly as possible to put a plan together.
Could you give me an example of what, you know, a plan might look like, even just like one aspect of it?
Well, one plan would be to restore it to the way it was, say, 40 years ago when things are level, green, and, you know, the population base was smaller at that time, too. But that's one, is to restore it to the way it was. The other extreme is to look at best use for the property. If we wanted to convert it into something with active internment, we would have to consider how you deal with all the unknowns and whether, I guess the extreme is to build memorials and then create more space for it or consider development in another way in the property by going above it. So it just depends what, you know, how much money people want to spend on something like this. But if we look toward memorializing and changing, not bringing in the ability to put more, intern more people in there, then it's a different model altogether from trying to take care of it from the way it looked 40 years ago. So those seems to be the two ends that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, and more than likely it will be somewhere in the middle of that spectrum.
Right, it's as far as funding will take us or other means, possibly a developer or something coming in. But we want to just explore all of that by first assessing what we have.
Keith, with a project like this and with a department now, a cemetery office, how do you look forward with something that is so limited by space that really feels like this is not sustainable? We're already running out of space in cemeteries. So what does planning for the future look like?
Well, for us, really, it's about taking care of what we currently have. We've got these 8 cemeteries that are scattered throughout the entire state. It's not just here on Oahu. We've also got a cemetery on the Big Island and one on Kauai. More could be added over time if the DLNR accepts cemeteries that become available and or get turned over to the state. So we're not sure what's going to take place in the future. But what I can say is this, that, and as Jimmy kind of alluded to, our goal is to fix and repair what we have currently, to do the best job that we possibly can to present a respectable, clean, very well maintained facility, cemetery, where people can go and visit their loved ones and reconnect with their ancestors in a safe environment, in a nice, welcoming environment. We talked a little bit about what does a cemetery look like, or what is your vision for that? And I would say that having worked for the county in the past in Maui and looking at how they've treated their veteran cemeteries, and you see the level of respect that's given to those individuals that are interred there, I really envision that our cemetery should be kept maybe not to the exact high standards as that, but certainly to a standard that's similar in nature. Because again, we have a responsibility, we have a duty to making sure that we take care of those facilities and those people that are there. And that's just our job.
Yeah.
So in terms of being sustainable, I think as long as, you know, as we start to identify projects that Jimmy was talking about, and we go to the legislature and we ask for their support to do different things with the properties, as an example, there could be a memorial that's created there. There could be higher grade fencing that's installed. There could be water lines that need to be installed in certain areas so that we can properly water. Who knows what needs to be done? But as we cross that bridge and we start to introduce those potential projects, that's where the public will have an opportunity to provide their input, and our legislators can either agree or not agree with what we're trying to do with those particular properties.
Keith, Jimmy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us, Maddie. We appreciate you. Mahalo. Thanks.
That was Comptroller and Acting Lieutenant Governor Keith Regan and James Carota of the Central Services Division. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about a drone survey of 8 cemeteries on Oahu, Kauai, and the island of Hawaii. The new cemetery office has been allocated $2.3 million to begin its work.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Tune in to HPR 2 at 3 p.m. this Sunday as the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Dane Lam, continues its celebration of the symphonies of Beethoven with dynamic performances of Symphony No. 4 and Symphony No. 6, Pastoral. We'll also hear Michael Thomas Fumai's original work, Becoming Beethoven. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
You know, this week we are launching a little different take on the Manu Minute. The popular segment was born here on The Conversation thanks to University of Hawaii biology professor Patrick Hart reaching out to suggest a platform for elevating these tiny voices across the state. Today we are featuring a Manu Minute that will hopefully provide more cultural context to our native feathered friends, many of which are endangered or threatened. We recently sat down with Hart and Lisa Mason, a member of the Bioacoustics Laboratory at UH Hilo. They also credit educator Keikuhi Kealii Kanakaole. She's with the Ahui Manu group that was formed to write Oli about our native birds. Hart starts us off.
So we thought this Oli was an idea of Keikuhi's to bring information about all the different Manu, the native ones in Hawaii, bring together scientific information, but just also just the long cultural history and all the different personal connections that people have had with birds over time, and try and bring them together into an ancient format in a new way. And I think probably Lisa would be a good person to describe the process of creating this Oli.
Well, Lisa, I know that when we were first chatting about this some years ago, when we were able to actually go out in the forest, right, and you get the inspiration and talk about these birds and why they mean so much to us. What was that like for you when you were getting started with this?
I remember feeling really honored to work with this group, Ahui Manu, and just the people that are involved in this group who are doing this work are just really amazing. We have historians and researchers and conservationists and just people who really, truly just love Hawaii's Manu as a part of this. And just to see people so inspired and for us to be together thinking about how we can convey this, these feelings of aloha and just the intention for abundance for these birds to our community is just very inspiring and humbling to think about. Being out in the forest, you realize what's at stake. There's so much that we need to do, and there's so much that could be lost. And it is our responsibility to convey to everyone, if they haven't already gotten the message, how important these manu really are. They are such an important part of Hawaii. They are Hawaii. And if we do lose these birds, we are losing a part of Hawaii that we can never get back. And unfortunately, there is that side of things too in the time that we live in now. And in doing some of the work that our Ahui Manu gang does, we realize that you have to find ways to connect and to be hopeful. And that's really where Okalele Ane Ona lives. It lives in this space of hope for our birds. Like I said, when you go into the forest, you really realize how amazing and beautiful these manu are and what the forest could be when you go to certain places and you see them. And we have so much to learn from our birds that it just is only right to try to capture some of that information that everybody can have access to and share and learn and interact with. It's a really practical thing for people to connect to our manu today.
You know, we just celebrated the Manu'oku Festival here on Oahu. And when we were out with the Audubon Society and we were up above the treetops, we were in a parking garage at Ala Moana Shopping Center. And to see these little birds and to hear the birds chirping above the noise of the city was incredible. And you talk about this feeling of humbleness. We're humbled to be able to give a platform for these tiny voices so that people can learn about just their special connection to our everyday lives on this earth. And it just was a wonderful feeling seeing these baby chicks in the trees, in their environment, in their urban environment. And for those of us who are not fortunate enough to be up in the native forest where you can see a lot of these native birds in their habitat, I think the Manu Minute and what we can do just to broadcast their story is important.
I agree.
And Patrick, we've had this spate of bad weather and there were, I think, some fatalities at the wildlife refuges. But I was thinking about the super typhoons over in Guam and the Northern Marianas. And I was thinking of, my gosh, when you've got storms with winds of 184 miles an hour and you're a little bird in a tree, like, what do you do? It's nature, but something to think about.
Personally, I'm worried about this. It's supposed to be a bad hurricane season this year with the El Nino, and I know that some of the past extinctions, for example, on Kauai, when I think it was Iniki hit in the early 90s, that was the last time we saw a couple different species of birds, including the o'u and I think the kama'o. But these birds can handle a lot, 150-mile-hour winds. They're not quite built for that. So that's the reason you want to not just have birds living in one place, but to have them in multiple places to help insure against catastrophes like hurricanes. And so in the past, it wouldn't have been such an issue because the birds were everywhere. But now they're just in a few localized special places. And so we have to be even more careful about protecting them because of that.
And Lisa, talk about creating the oli when you tell their story.
Yeah, well, I've learned so much from our Ahui Manu team, like I said, in Auntie Kekuhi in the art of oli. And I am still very much a learner and a beginner in this craft, but I'm always impressed by our Kanaka orators and storytellers in the way that they can really lead us on a journey using their voice. I mean, you've probably felt that like chicken skin, yeah, like when you hear it somewhere. And when you hear the voice being woven in that way, it's just really a beautiful thing. And it seems to align, right, the mind, and it helps you to listen. And so using Oli as a medium to engage people is really appropriate. It's also a really big part of our Kanaka culture. There's many practitioners of Oli who can take this and run with it, which is what we hope. And as Kanaka, we know how important it is for us to attune ourselves to our environment. And we never want to try to exceed that which exists in nature or try to outmatch the energies of a place. So, you know, Oli is a way that we can attune ourselves and vibe with the natural frequencies that are around us. And sometimes all we have is our voice to offer, to connect and to respond. And in this case, to teach. And I know this is where Pat and I come in and others on our Ahui Manu team as bioacoustic researchers. We definitely know how important sounds are to the lived experience and how it can illustrate the complexities of our environment that maybe we can take for granted if we don't stop and listen and engage in that way. So Okalele, it's a wonderful collaborative project that was started some years ago. Many different types of people that have contributed to this Oli. And I kind of came in a little ways into the project where the format and the intention was set. And one of the things we really wanted to lean into was really digging into Kumulipo and the structure of the Kumulipo and using that as a framework for building this Oli and really just connecting and letting the past kind of inform the future. And it's just really a brilliant way to capture information. Everybody who's been a part of a Hui Manu has been contributing not only their knowledge about the birds, but their own personal experiences with these Manu. And so it really is a living document that we want to share. And if you take some time to just look over the Kumulipo, one of the versions that we have today, there's different segments in it. And it's in the third epoch or the third va that we see the Manu really presented to us. And so each pauku or verse in the Oli is inspired from Kumulipo. And the Kumulipo is, if you don't know, a traditional cosmological chant that focuses on the origins of things as we know them here in Hawaii. And so in the Oli starts with an introduction that calls out the abundance that we are seeking for Hawaii. So it calls out a sky full of flocks of birds that once thrived in these islands. And then each verse then follows a similar style to the Kumulipo that calls out associations between our ocean and land creatures that we want to use to build support for the birds through these unique relationships. And right now we have about 30 pauku, each one dedicated to a specific Manu Maoli, our native bird in Hawaii.
And Patrick, this project has evolved from when you reached out to us with this idea of featuring our birds. And I remember years ago, not long after we talked, I was at the Mission House Museum Historic Sites and happened to see Sam Gaughan, and they were doing a Oli and a mele and hula around one of our native birds. And it was just really, it was chicken skin. It was just like, wow, this is what we were talking about, just to deepen our understanding and appreciation from this place where we live.
Yeah. One thing about birds, just to follow up on that and what Lisa just mentioned, is the sound of birds is all around us, but we often don't pay attention to that. And one part of this Oli is to bring the sound of the birds into the Oli to help form connections between people and the Manu by bring the sound in. And then the last part of each verse, we try and imitate the sound that each bird makes. And I think that's really a fun part of the Oli, but it also forms a great way of connecting with the Manu as well by trying to imitate their kani or their sound. And so that's going to be part of this new Ahui Manu Minute, is we'll be presenting the song of the bird and then inviting people to try and imitate it on their own, the way we do when we do the ole in public, which is always fun when you get a room full of adults all trying to imitate a bird very poorly. It's definitely a lighthearted.
Yeah, imitation is best flattery, right?
Yeah.
Thank you both for sharing just the concept behind this Mono Minute 2.0.
My pleasure. Our pleasure.
All right.
Been great. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Mahalo.
We have been hearing from Lisa Mason and UH Hilo Professor Patrick Hart. The new Ahui Manu Minute will run once a month on Wednesdays. The conversation will continue to re-air existing Manu Minute segments throughout the month. Now here's Patrick Hart with this week's Manu Minute.
Aloha, this is Patrick Hart from UH Hilo Department of Biology. We're bringing you a special series called Ahui Manu Minute that explores our cultural connection to Hawaii's native birds. It's built around an ole led by Kekuhi Kealii Kanaka Ole o Haile Lani. Today you'll hear a portion of the ole that focuses on the nene, or Hawaiian goose. Lisa Mason with UH Hilo Lohe Bioacoustics Lab will guide you through its meaning. Take a listen.
O ka lele a nei au na o ka haka I a la lani o ho o noho noho a pa. Ha na o ka nene kani. Kia ia kalimu kalanoho ikei, ola mauloi ki kukai nene noho iuka. O ka nene auna lele a paa, paa hia.
The nene is born. It resounds. Accompanied by the limukala which dwells at sea, healthy and ever-enduring through the kukai nene which dwells inland. The nene flies in droves everlasting. They are secured. Nene are mentioned in the Kumulipo as being guardian spirits of the land and are one of the rarest geese in the world. The ole ties them with limukala from the sea and the upland vine kukai nene that produces the shiny, dark purple berries that are one of their favorite foods. As you listen to the call of the nene, we invite you to join us in imitating their kani, to offer a pulse of vitality for their success. Mahalo Ahui Manu for today's oli, and thanks to UH Hilo Lohe Lab for the recordings of the Nene. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Lisa Mason.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering adventures on Hawaii Island for kama'aina and visitors for more than 30 years. Learn more at hawaii-forest.com.
Well, we're all out of time, but up tomorrow we plan to hear from Hawaiian Electric Company about how your power bill could be affected by the war in Iran. Worried about how much the rates could rise? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.